All right. Thanks, Andreas. No, I'm delighted to be here. I do feel slightly like a fish out of water, but I have now been collaborating with a number of lattice gauge theorists for some time now on a number of works. Two of them are in the audience, Enrico and George back there, and there are several others who have been at the workshop, either already been here or perhaps may come still in the latter parts of it. So the work I'll talk about is sort of based on these papers here that are all, okay, you can find them. And, you know, because it is a Blackboard talk, I'll say a few things. I'm actually gonna, because of sort of the diverse audience, I'm gonna give a longer introduction as to why I'm doing what I'm doing, how I got into this. And so that will mean that some of the, you know, the details of a lot of this will end up in the papers, and I think that's probably better for everyone. But again, if people want to, you know, probe me in great detail about many other things, I'm around till the end of the week, so I'm happy to chat. Okay. All right, so dark matter. It exists, right? And we know this from, you know, galaxies, clusters, merging of clusters in particular. Oh, there's BAO, baryonic acoustic oscillations, and maybe my favorite, CMB, which, you know, you've seen all of these plots. There's my sketch of it, okay? The power spectrum of the CMB. And, you know, it took some time before sort of the full set of, you know, all of this came through, but, and I have to say, I've been around long enough to remember when sort of only this much was known down here, okay, and people were speculating about all sorts of crazy things that could happen. But now we know a great number of things about the universe, but in particular, sort of the combination of the heights of the second and the third peak is sort of unambiguously telling us there's an additional component of matter that doesn't interact like baryons, like charged particles. Okay. So this is probably the single piece of evidence that right away, if you thought that, oh, yes, I'll just modify gravity on galactic scales, and I'll solve my dark matter problem. It's not consistent with this. It's not obviously consistent with this. Yeah. So dark matter is there, and it is one piece of new physics that we know we have to have. We don't know what it is, though, right? We only know that it has gravitational interactions with us. So then the question is, well, what, you know, what could it be? If we specialize to, broadly speaking, WIMPs, so, and I'm putting quotes around it because historically this came from so-called weakly interacting, you know, massive particles. But as you'll see, you know, weak interactions have long since been sort of ruled out as being likely the origin or the interactions that they could have with us, at least full-strength weak interactions. WIMPs, yeah, so there's many, many different kinds of WIMPs, many different kinds of things you could do, but I would say the one principal piece of evidence that would make you think that this is something to consider is that the density of dark matter is roughly 5 times the density of matter or baryons today. So, you know, if it were any other sort of particle, it could have been a whole different, whole range. You know, this could have been much, much larger, much, much smaller, and, you know, of course, you can then think about the universes that you would have that have varying ranges and whether they are habitable and so forth. I'm not getting into that today, okay? But at least the idea that these numbers are comparable is suggestive of an origin that requires interactions with the standard model. So WIMPs, so what could lead to this sort of relation? There are several, you know, possible abundance stories that you can think about. Of course, the common one that people often speak of is thermal production in the early universe, but it also could have come from, for example, an asymmetry. That is to say that we already know that the baryons had as their origin some primordial, presumably baryogenesis or like mechanism that generated their slight, you know, slight amount of baryons over antibaryons. And of course, if this is somehow related to dark matter, it's possible that this sort of relation becomes sort of automatic. And again, that, you know, you could give entire sort of seminars about that and different possibilities for where you'd go with that. I'm just sort of motivating the idea that having WIMP, broadly speaking, like particles around, can motivate, can tell you something about this abundance relation, broadly, anyway. If I then impose an additional constraint, which certainly doesn't have to be true with respect to, you know, dark matter, but if I impose also sort of the constraint of what is possibly observable in sort of the, you know, horizon, you know, what can we find? At least with respect to WIMPs, broadly speaking, I could say that if I take the dark matter mass larger than roughly a few GeV, then it is at least potentially observable through nuclear recoil. Of direct detection experiments. Direct detection. Okay, and I'll explain that in just a second. If it were roughly less, again, you know, squiggle art here, a TeV or so, then you're in the territory where colliders could probe this. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that any given particle within this range automatically can be found this way or that way, or both. But if it's sort of, if it's outside of this range, then at least one or the other of these things is going to become very difficult. Okay, so that's a very sort of simple statement about sort of the scales that might be interesting to probe. So with that in mind, then.
So these are the probable scales.
Oh, probable. That's putting.
No, possible. No, that can be probed.
Probable scales.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Almost caught me. All right.
Not necessarily the same thing.
For the direct detection experiments, they can probe scales higher than a TeV.
Oh yes, 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 yes.
It doesn't imply that there's a limit for direct detection.
To be sure, and you'll. Yeah, I will. I'll. I'm getting there.
Maybe.
So, going to George's comment, it's sort of hard to understand, I think it's hard to understand why you'd even sort of get into this business without sort of at least staring at what we know about direct detection. So here I get to draw a plot, which is, that's the joy of Blackboard, I get to draw. Whatever I draw is automatically right, so it's fantastic. So it's, let me try to get this more or less straight. Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. Let me draw the line first. So this is the dark matter mass. This is the per nucleon total cross section. Here. This is the latest bound from LUX, a underground experiment in South Dakota involving xenon. These are some other experiments. I don't remember what they are off the top of my head, but ones that involve much lighter elements. Okay, I'll tell you what that is. So just again, to set all the scales here, roughly this is 10, maybe 100, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. And one. Okay, so the origin of this statement, the idea that there's a lower bound, is coming from the fact that there is no sensitivity to very low masses. And this is coming from indirect detection experiments when you have a WIMP that comes in and scatters off a nucleus. Okay, it does an elastic scattering. By the way, what I'm talking about here is primarily spin-independent. I won't really have any comments about spin-dependent, but sort of similar statements follow. So for spin-independent scattering, elastic scattering, where the WIMP just comes in and scatters off a nucleus, eventually the energy of this nucleus is so small that you can't observe it in the detector. More specifically, in many of these detectors, there are thresholds whereby they say, I'm not looking for any, I can't observe recoil energies below a certain critical amount. And so what that means is that to be able to probe very light wimps, you have to go out onto the velocity distribution. So if I do this in, say, the galactic frame, then there have been simulations, there are sort of, you know, ideas about what this velocity distribution would look like. One possibility is sort of roughly something like that, where whether this comes down here or comes here, okay, these are all details that are beyond, well beyond the scope of this talk. But in any case, there is a sort of a cutoff velocity, escape velocity of the galaxy. And so when you're down at this mass range, you have to probe, or you can only probe, very small velocities to be able to, you know, get at direct detection. So eventually you get low enough in dark matter mass, and you have to push way out beyond the escape velocity, so you have no sensitivity.
Graham, you did not put a scale on the cross section.
That's good. Yes, that's true. I didn't need that just for this. Okay.
Where is the Z-exchange cross section on this?
I will tell you. Yeah. No, I'll tell you. Very good.
Just remind us.
So first, roughly here is 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared. Okay. And I'll put the Z-exchange. I'm going to talk about it in just a second.
Okay.
Okay. Great. So that's the origin of this end. Of course, on this end, the idea that it sort of slowly scales up, that is to say that the bound is scaling as roughly 1 over the mass of the dark matter. And this is coming simply because as you get to very large dark matter masses, the cross-section is approaching a constant. And this is because for the non-relativistic scattering, you're being dominated by the reduced mass, which is identifying the nucleus rather than the dark matter mass once you get, you know, beyond hundreds of GeV. So it approaches a constant, which then means then that if I keep raising the dark matter mass up, the assumption is that the local density of dark matter is approximately constant to some value. Something also that is, of course, open to, you know, astrophysical speculation as to what it could be. But if this is constant, this is the number density of dark matter divided by the mass of the dark matter. So if I keep on increasing the dark matter mass, then to keep the local density constant, I have to lower the number density. And so that means my flux goes down, and so my bound goes down. That's it. Okay, so that's the status of sort of spin-independent direct detection.
So claims by Dalma, et cetera, of observation are discredited, or there's some wriggle room out?
Another whole seminar that you could give about that. If it were a normal elastic scattering process, it would be, I don't know precisely, but sort of somewhere in this range. There's sort of two regions. So there would be sort of one range here and maybe one range over there. Yeah. If it's not, so I'll go to then the issue of what this cross-section is and why it's used and where it could be misused in just a moment. But if it is in fact, you know, this way of interpreting it, if you think it's spin-independent elastic, then yeah, Dalma's gone.
Are there some standard distributions of velocities that are used to produce those limits?
There are, and they, I think the experiments, when they try to compare to each other, they try to use the same thing, to the best of my knowledge. And you can ask questions about what happens when you know, very radically change the velocity profile. Again, a wonderful talk for another time. I'm not going to get into that here.
But when you see all this plot with all the different constraints, they use all the same distribution.
I mean, they should be. I don't know if they are, but they should be. Yeah. Okay. Certainly, once you get down sort of in this territory here, you have to be careful about, you know, what you're doing. Yeah. Okay. So just...
Dalma is sodium, right? And lux is xenon.
It's sodium iodide. So that means you could have scattering off either the sodium or the iodine. And that will tend to favor one or the other sort of regions that have been fit. You know, and I haven't plotted many other, you know,
direct nuclear effects that could allow Dhamma in light of flux.
It seems unlikely, given that there is another experiment called KIMS that also uses iodine, and to my knowledge, they haven't seen any detection. So if it were something very unusual, specific to iodine, I think we'd probably already know about it. Okay, so just to clarify then what this quantity is here. So this sigma naught comes from writing the total cross-section. So sigma, here we go. This is cube squared. So if I integrate over the differential cross-section, I get a total. Wonderful. And this is, in dark matter terminology, usually written as the sigma naught, so the quantity I have over there, divided by 4 mu squared, d squared, integral of d, mu squared, f. Where what I have sort of, what people have rashly done is to pull out the nuclear structure factor from this computation, and instead just compare sort of this cross-section at zero momentum, effectively. So this is dependent on a number of things, but the way it's already been written, it sort of implicitly assumes I've been doing something like Higgs exchange. Okay, I'll come back to that in just a moment. And it also, so it obviously depends on the element or the nuclei involved, and on the range of Q squared by which the experiment decides to probe. Okay, so that will go into getting their total rate, but they try to unfold that, at least with respect to getting to sigma naught. Generally speaking, just for those who may be thinking about this off the top of my head, or off the top of their head, for example, the Lux collaboration have an upper and a lower bound on the range of Q squared, which they probe, so that they're trying to keep this factor not that far from one. Okay, so it hopefully is not super sensitive to nuclear effects. Okay?
It's assumed it's not diffractive.
Assumes it's not diffractive.
It's not. Well, you mentioned elastic scattering.
Yes.
It's been scaled by the cross-section per nucleon.
Oh, yeah, I'm just going to say that right next. Yeah. Let me now just tell you what that is.
What's mu in this nucleon? Yeah.
Sorry, this is the reduced mass. Yeah, thank you. So this is velocity.
For a single nucleus?
Yeah, let me now tell you the conversion. So the conversion is that sigma naught, this is the per nucleon, is mu squared of em nucleon, mu squared nucleus. Okay, this is, I mean, if you like, this is a definition. Okay, so this definition was chosen because a typical nuclear scattering cross-section is proportional to, okay, things, but they include, say, A minus Z times the mass of the neutron, F neutron. Quantity squared. This would be true for something like Higgs exchange. Okay, it would be something like this. For a general interaction, you just have to sort of understand what is the effective interaction with the neutrons and the protons. This is the way it's usually factorized. And then for Higgs exchange, this becomes something that effectively the A number factors out, and I get an A squared M nucleon squared F squared, okay? And so this proportionality to A squared in the nuclear cross-section per nucleus is then canceled by this a squared put here, so that experiments with different nuclei can try to compare what they think is sort of the same quantity, and so that the particular nucleus is sort of dropping out of the comparison.
Why is the focus so much on Higgs exchange?
Oh, very good. That's a good question. Ask experimentalists that. That would be my first comment.
I'll say that theorists told them to think about it.
I would say some theorists told them to do that, and those probably told them a long time ago, before bounds were at this level. But yeah. So that means that's why whenever you see a plot like this, and then you see projections of, here's what Lux 1,000 days, or here's what a one-ton detector or an argon detector can do, those lines are under this assumption of comparing the per-nucleon cross-section with this scaling, and so sort of implicitly assuming Higgs exchange as the way of comparing one experiment to another. Okay, good. So now, how does interact? We know it interacts gravitationally, but if it's a WIMP in sort of this broad territory that I'm sort of motivating here, then there's many, many, many possibilities. I'll never review them all. Let me just throw a couple of examples out as the ones to just sort of have, in the back of your mind as something to start with. And there is, large numbers of references to consider all of the different possibilities that you might imagine. The classic one would be, let's say for a moment that I take my WIMP to be a fermion, just for fun, and I do Z exchange, and I compute this cross-section, and I get a number that's of order for sort of, weak scale masses of order 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared. Now, you can keep cranking on the mass of the dark matter. It doesn't really change this significantly because eventually you're just dominated by the reduced mass of the process. So 10 to the minus 38 on this plot is sort of, up here somewhere. Okay. So it's very high up. You can sort of begin to figure out how heavy I need to make this thing before I finally would be allowed again with Z exchange. And it's going to be, hundreds of TeV or larger. Now, again, just to sort of to emphasize, I've drawn this as a Feynman diagram at sort of what would almost smell like something I might do at a collider. Obviously, in a experiment that's operating at exchange energies that is the sort of characteristic velocities of the galaxy, multiplying by the mass, which is keV level recoil energies. We're talking about hundreds of keV, sort of at that level. And this interaction, of course, is really secretly, better described as just an effective theory where I've integrated this thing, and I have the WIMP as a non-relativistic field. And again, there's a large literature on doing this and doing the matching. Richard Hill and Michael Solon, for example, have done a wonderful series of papers on doing this matching, but they're not the only ones. There's been, several people who've been involved in that. Okay, so another possibility, and this is the one that I keep referring to, Higgs exchange. So now if I compute that rate, so to compute this, I need to know the coupling of the Higgs to the dark matter. Let me just imagine that is some Yukawa coupling that I'll normalize to the dark matter mass, just for fun. It's Higgs exchange, but we know the mass of the Higgs now, so that's not really a variable, but in case you wanted to see it explicit, there it is. Then it depends on the effective Higgs interaction with nucleus or nuclei, and then I have to go to that. And of course, this is a case where, this audience, this workshop, lattice calculations have had, you know, a significant impact directly in terms of, for example, the strange content of the nucleus, of the nuclei, nucleons, I should say, nucleons. Strange content of the nucleons, which, you know, 15 years ago was thought to be, I would say, somewhat larger than it is now, and so that has, you know, sort of changed the effective strength of the Higgs with nucleons by a factor of 2 or 3 or so, which then gets, you know, squared in the cross section. So it's a non-trivial, it was a very non-trivial input that went directly into dark matter research was in that quantity.
So just so you know, some of the large numbers used in dark matter studies and BSM studies have been told by sort of hadronic nuclear physicists like Ulf Meissner. No serious person took those numbers seriously.
Okay.
My retort, nevertheless, they were used in the literature by these people I'm talking about. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. great. You want to see their names? Being recorded, so I can walk up and...
Can I ask a model-building question? In sort of vanilla scenarios, like supersymmetry, what is the favorite candidate that has Higgs exchange but not Z exchange?
Right. So I'll answer that in 30 seconds.
Okay.
Just to wrap this thing up, so I wanted to just make sort of the shout out to the strangeness content and its role in getting Higgs exchange on the nuclear side. And if you just sort of, you know, if you put in the numbers and compute, you get ballpark 43 centimeters squared here. Okay. So that would correspond to maybe, I don't know where I want to put this on the plot, but... don't get too hung up on exactly where I put the crossing point, but something of that territory. So a full strength, weakly interacting 100 GeV mass dark matter particle that had, you know, all of its mass or most of its mass arising from electroweak breaking, not considering any of the other constraints that might have from other standard model processes, that's already ruled out. Handily ruled out. So that means that you need to take this Yukawa to be small, sort of, you know, 10 to the minus 1 is about where you would need for, again, sort of, you know, in this sort of territory here. There is a paper, just in case, for those who want more on this, 2.6287. And these guys, this is one of a multitude of different possible papers you could look at. But these guys looked at specifically sort of Higgs and Z exchange. Maybe not Z exchange so much, they did look at this and Higgs exchange, but also with other more elaborate couplings that you can imagine where, say, the Z is not coupling vector-like, but it's maybe to an axial coupling to the fermion. Or similarly, whether this is the nature of these couplings to the dark matter may change from scalar to pseudoscalar and so forth. And then they have sort of parameterized the strength, the constraints that you get within sort of this space of WIMPs that are potentially observable, you know, in this sort of broad range. And that's more or less consistent with what I've already told you just by sort of writing down, you know, these squiggles here. Okay.
So if you have a Z exchange, what are the constraint from that?
Sorry, from LEP or from direct detection?
No, from, you know, you have a Z to nothing, and so there are limits on that.
Oh, yeah, but you could imagine you had, say, a fourth generation neutrino that was heavier than MZ over 2. And so then, you know, the invisible width would not be the direct constraint.
But if you produce these dark matter, if they are too light, we produce them at LEP.
Right. So you're correct. There are constraints. There are absolutely constraints on Z invisible Z width into stuff once you're below sort of 45. Yep. That's absolutely true. And there are also constraints on Higgs decay if it interacts strongly with that into other stuff as well. So absolutely there are constraints on the strengths of these things, and they're important. Yeah, some of the width constraints were mentioned in this paper as well. Yeah. So you can look. They did not only the direct detection, but also they looked at a number of other constraints that would impact this.
Getting back to Eric's question, if it's a LSP and a SUSY model, we know all the couplings.
Mm-hmm. We know it subject to the SUSY parameters.
Like which set their masses. Did you know that the Yukawa coupling of the...
So all you know...
Don't you know the coupling of a neutrino to the Higgs?
The simple answer is no, we don't know it.
Why not?
Because it depends on the mixing between the different states of the neutrino. So the lightest neutrino, which would behave as the dark matter, is a mixture of, you know, in the MSSM, it's the Beano, the Higgsino, and the Wino. And the key is that in the neutrino mass matrix, there are terms over here that look like G prime V, prime V, G, V, G, and similarly over here. So the Higgs is interacting through, right, generalizing this V to V plus H. So then that corresponds to the mixing between Higgsino and Beano or Wino. Right? That's fundamentally where a Higgs interaction is coming from. But if I had very, very heavy Higgsinos or very heavy M1, M2, or any other combination, then the effect of this is arbitrarily small. Well, okay, I say arbitrarily small, I have to be careful. That's the tree level exchange, the tree level coupling. Then I have to think about higher order corrections and whether they impact it. And that's a whole other, you know, sort of amusing and interesting story. Here's what I will say, though. There's another paper, I don't have the reference off the top of my head, but it includes Rudderman, Hall, and you've already had the names backwards, but and others, I apologize to the others, okay, where they looked at sort of the constraints on this parameter space from sort of existing direct detection and what was anticipated to be future direct detection experiments. And it's already at a stage where the sort of mixed Beano, Higgsino, and mixed Wino Higgsino regions are already highly constrained because of the Lux constraint, the Lux factor. So, which is really boiling down to, no matter how you cut it, right, you seem to have to put in a small number here. If you want to live in this region, you've got to put in a small number to suppress the ray. Okay. All right. Okay. So, let me erase this. So where are we now? So how do you evade? Okay, so what I've tried to motivate anyway is that the sort of vanilla WIMP, your advisor's WIMP, maybe my advisor's WIMP, I don't know.
What is his favorite WIMP now?
I no comment. Okay. Moving on. Your advisor's WIMP or my grad student days WIMP is not one that is particularly viable anymore. It's not to say you can't find some region of parameter space to make this go, but you effectively are having to try to tune down the interaction with Higgs and minimize, you know, these constraints. So it's not trivial to make it go. I should add though that, of course, there are many candidates that are sort of at the TEV and a little bit larger range that are really quite perfectly viable. For example, a pure Higgsino in supersymmetry is a perfectly viable candidate, partly due to its effective interactions with the Higgs are suppressed by loops and accidents. So a combination of a loop and an accident means it's very suppressed. You can get the relic density correct if you're sort of at 1.1 TeV. The problem with that is that a Higgsino at 1.1 TeV with this highly suppressed Higgs interaction, I mean, so suppressed that it's 10 to the minus 48 or lower in cross-section. Not obviously going to be seen in the next 10 years, and not certainly not obviously going to be seen in colliders in the next 10 years. Okay, so yes, it's an interesting viable candidate. It's not obviously detectable.
It's probable, but not probable.
Well,
you're trying to get a small number, but you could have a small number coming from a moderately small number at the particle physics side, a moderately small number at the nuclear scale, and then a moderately small number coming out of the dark matter flux, right? So you could have.
Yes. True. Expanding on the ways of getting around this, of course, it's possible that, you know, while this is basically a fixed number averaged over all of cosmology, the local dark matter density, very local with respect to what this is really testing, is not known at all. It's only known sort of averaged over some region. Okay, we can speak about to what extent we believe that number and what the range of which that could be. But we could live in a void, and then that would significantly reduce that number. You could do that. As to whether you can change these sides, so I mentioned something about how you would change the mediators with dark matter. And as I said, this is one example of a paper, one of a large literature that has looked at many elaborate ways of modifying that. On this side, I mean, normal Higgs interaction with the nuclei, I think, is pretty much set. I don't really see that changing significantly. I also don't see Z changing here either. However, if you modify what the mediator may be, so the mediator is something else, then all bets are off, and then you can.
Well, I certainly agree that Higgs interaction with the nucleon is completely fixed. The nucleus, it can be a factor of 30%.
Yeah, that's sort of now. Yeah, right. That's sort of in
so
that
then
noise.
You need other 30% to get a factor of 10.
Yeah, I mean, you know, once the next Lux bound comes out, it will probably be another order of magnitude or so down. So, you know, you can buy factors of 2 maybe here or there, but that's quickly going to erode.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, how could you evade? So, there are, broadly speaking, 3 ways. Very light, heavy, small coupling. I mean, it's sort of obvious, right? But if it's very light, then you evade these constraints. I mean, it's maybe not a surprise that there's a large number of people who are interested in very light dark matter with light mediators and so forth. You know, they don't have to face these constraints. They instead have to look at other kinds of constraints that would come at them. Again, that's not the topic for today. Heavy. This will help you once you get somewhat heavy as you get further out, but it can also help you in the sense that, well, I erased it here, but in the sense that if the mixing parameter, if the effective coupling of, say, a Higgs is something that is controlled by, you know, multiple parameters, of which when you raise them large, you get something like electroweak, you know, YV squared divided by a large mass here, then you automatically get sort of a small coupling. But of course, that's really arising because you've taken the dark matter mass heavy, right? Okay. So that's what I mean by heavy. But here I really have in mind, you know, things like the Higgsino, and there are cousins of this sort of variety, and there are various other candidates, but I'm not going to go into the full range of that. And then small coupling. Okay. Great. All right. So that's sort of the introduction. But hey, you know, now we're all on board, okay, with how I think about this. So broadly speaking, this is the territory I'm going to be sort of interested in, sort of from weak scale on up to maybe heavy scales, okay, very broadly. What's the point? Well, I need to do one more very brief sort of introductory remarks on Now here I feel like I might overlap Ethan, I don't know. I wasn't here for it. I don't know how many others were already here, so if this overlaps, I apologize, but let me at least state a couple of things about why going from an elementary dark matter candidate to a composite candidate, at least composite at the scale of sort of the weak scale, is potentially interesting. So one thing right away is that you can imagine that the interactions go as, you know, sum over m dark matter power, some higher dimensional operators, where I'm just going to denote the dimension of the operator by 4 plus n, and then suppressed by the dark matter mass, or say the compositeness scale, okay, depending on how I relate these two, to some high powers. So I have at least the possibility of, first of all, sort of removing the scale mz from this picture, and I also have the possibility of removing the scale m Higgs from the exchange sort of picture, and replacing it with, you know, a dark matter or a compositeness scale. So that at least looks potentially promising. And then I can also imagine, you know, adjusting or imagining scenarios where n is not, say, 1 or 2 or whatever it may, whatever you may imagine it could, to be, but it could be larger. In fact, by the end of the day, I'll be interested in a case when n is equal to 3. Okay. And that will be the leading interaction. Good. What else? The next comment really depends a little bit more on whether you're a model builder or just a pragmatist. So for the model builders in the world, we like technical naturalness generally. Now, I admit that we have not seen that in the Higgs sector yet. No evidence of that. So so you can either take that as the indication that we don't have technical naturalness at all anywhere. That is to say that everything we've learned about effective field theory up to the discovery of the Higgs has been sort of, you know, deluding ourselves as to the fundamental principles. Or it is that somehow it is still, you know, potentially technically natural. But I don't know what to make of the Higgs, but I could at least imagine that the dark matter sector remains technically natural. And at least for a compositeness, for a theory that confines, right, I get a new dynamical scale in the problem. And so that's wonderful. I will also have fermion masses, but that's not new, and there's nothing new about adding the technical naturalness of, you know, some vector like fermion mass. But just to be clear, I'll have both of these things. Okay. So
can you say in a few words what technical naturalness is?
Right. Yeah. So it's just this is simply the statement that that radiated corrections to any of the parameters of the theory are multiplicatively renormalized. So unlike the Higgs sector, where naively I add new sectors to it and I could, you know, scales would suddenly get pulled up, here that won't happen in this theory. This is a concern that you could have on this end, right? Because people will often speak of light mediators, for example, a light U1 that is the exchange particle, you know, leading to these theories, and that U1 would have to be broken by a Higgs. That Higgs generally has to have a very small expectation value, otherwise the particles are not light. Okay, so then you can ask about how do you arrange for that to be very small. Even worse is that you know that there are operators such as, you know, lambda phi dark, say dagger phi dark, Higgs dagger Higgs. Okay, so at the renormalizable level, I can already see the potential disruption of the scale here. I'm not saying this happens in all theories. I mean, this just depends on how you build this theory, but generically, you have to worry about it. Okay, so technical naturalness is sort of motivating how I think about it. There is another wonderful fact of this that follows just from, you know, QCD. We know that we have a great stability symmetry, U1 baryon number, U1b number. And so if I have a new strong sector of the theory, I can easily imagine a new baryon number. that can be, you know, sufficiently preserved that it keeps the baryon stable, even with respect to sort of, you know, arbitrary Planck suppressed effects. Okay, so baryon number, or I should say that dark matter stability can be automatic, is a possibility here. And at least with respect to the ability of probing these types of theories, there is a rich spectrum of states. Just as in QCD. So we have, you know, mesons and baryons. And they're states that could be probed by the LHC. Amusingly, of course, as is typical in these theories, the baryons being heavier than the mesons, meaning these are much easier to produce, just like the mesons of QCD are much easier to produce. And so they would be the first states to begin to observe. But because the mesons don't carry any conserved quantum number, they will decay entirely to standard model states. So this is a case where the leading prediction for observations of this sector is not a missing energy signal. So usually you hear, you know, LHC, they look, okay, we want to look for missing energy signals because we want to look for dark matter. That's not the thing you look for here. Okay, so it does change the perspective of what, how, you know, how to think about search strategies that the LHC will have.
You haven't told us how the standard model interacts with that dark QCD.
Nope, I haven't, not yet. I'm going to tell you that now or within, yeah, very soon. Okay. Any other, okay, all right. Let me solve this. Okay, so let's suppose, and this is what finally I can tell you about the model. So the model is just a new SUN dark, not at all connected to QCD, with some number of flavors of fermions, dark fermions, that transform under just the electroweak group. Okay, so the interactions, there has to be some interaction with the standard model.
We group the vector symmetry or the chiral symmetry of that theory?
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll give you exactly the spectrum and then you'll see. Yeah. Okay, so this is the basic idea. This is not new. Many people have thought about sort of these proposals before. At some level, you know, a lot of this goes back to imagining that Technicolor could have been the symmetry that, or could have been the new force that would have dynamically broken the Higgs. That does not seem to be the case anymore. Okay, at least, you know, with naive understanding of the Higgs sector and its couplings and so forth, and the lack of other corroborating evidence. So that wonderful idea. Yes. Anyway, so that wonderful idea is okay. We have to move on. So we're left with imagining a new dark sector, and then and its sole purpose is to sort of give rise to the scales and the interactions needed to give rise to dark matter. Now, once I write this thing down, you could right. So let me, I should have just told Eric right away. So these fermions will...
Others are interested too.
Say what? Yeah, no, funny. So these fermions will transform under a vector-like representation of the electroweak group, but also allow for Higgs interactions. And that doesn't seem obvious and is not obvious right now why you would want that. I'll tell you later. Okay, but these are sort of, these would be the leading requirements. But before I even get there, you could ask, well, what's N? Okay, well, one doesn't work. Two, three, four, you keep going. So there are some things that I sort of, I look to this list and decide how much emphasis I put on them, but What one piece of it might be stability. And another thing might be, are these interactions that I would imagine coming from this theory going to allow the dark matter to be detectable? That is not obviously a requirement that nature has, but it's going to be one that I'm going to be interested in simply for the purposes of what could still exist near the electroweak scale, hiding from us very carefully. Okay, so from that point of view of, you know, there's obviously a broad range of parameter space you can probe, lots of different things could be going on, but if I'm interested in what could the LHC be finding, what could direct detection be finding, then I'm interested in the lowest scales. So if I want to restrict that, I might say operators that, so cases where n is not 1 and maybe n is not 2. Okay? And if I do that, then this can potentially work, so that's fine. Stability, the problem here is that if I imagine I have my baryon interacting with the Higgs through, say, a Planck-suppressed operator like that, and I'm not saying that has to be true, but this is one thing I could write, this will obviously violate baryon number at dimension 5 level and lead to dark matter decay on sort of a time scale of, I don't remember if it's a month, a week, or a year, but... Okay. So I'm not going to consider 2 for this reason. That doesn't mean to say you couldn't try to enforce this symmetry to be better, to be more exact. You can try to play those games. I'm not going to do that, so I'm just not going to consider issue 2. Some level, another reason not to consider issue 2 is already very special.
The theory is anomaly free, so why would there be this interaction? I'm confused.
Why would there be this interaction? Yeah. Oh, I'm just saying I can't.
Quantum gravity induces it or what?
Okay, sure. It's okay, but we know already by n equal to 3 that this the same interaction I would have written down for proton decay, right, is completely safe with respect to Planck-suppressed operators, again, with respect to experiments. So that's fine, and if I keep on going, it's certainly more and more fine because the operator gets to higher dimension. Okay, so that's all fine. 3 has the problem that the baryons carry spin, and that leads to the possibility of n equal to 1 type operators, magnetic moments interactions. And so that tends to, or that's already been shown by the LSD collaboration earlier, before I was part of it, to be larger than, I think, I don't remember exactly what the number is now, but sort of 20 TeV or so. Okay. So at least directly probing the dark matter sector will be tricky here. Okay, so that sort of led us to go. Issue 4.
Sorry, can you say once again why you're interested in this small n being different from 1 and 2? No, the second small n. So this number of composites.
Direction is too strong.
It's too strong.
For light masses.
Correct. That's right. Okay. And you would, I think you would imagine that you could take SUN, even n, you know, 4 or larger, and this is all going to sort of follow. So one interesting thing about starting here is that it, you know, could be suggestive of what a much wider class of theories could actually have. Okay. Whereas if I had done SU2, I'd never be completely sure whether this was special to SU2 because of, you know, SU2 is special.
Well, there is an advantage to SU4, which is because of Will's calculation that shows that as you increase n, you know, the splitting between the baryons and the mesons gets bigger, so you force to push the baryon mass up relative to where you think your detection limits are for the mesons and LHC.
Yeah, that's right. And, yep, that...
Or in somehow is probably a better candidate than some higher end. Well, I don't know, it depends.
Yeah.
If you want a lighter dark matter particle.
Sure.
Yeah, will you explain how to get the Higgs interactions?
Yeah, I'll do that right now. Okay. So, how do we arrange for a theory? So now this is my one sort of model building sort of piece of paper, and then I'll depart from it. So this is mainly for because of Eric. I'm gonna blame Eric for this one. Okay. So the matter content. And I'm going to write it with respect to the electroweak quantum numbers so you can see where the Higgs interactions come from.
Oh, they don't carry color, right?
They don't carry color. Yep.
So people would yell at you, oh, you give up on unification with that.
Oh, unification. Oh my goodness. Do I have to give you my lecture about unification?
Well, we used to have grand designs, you know? They're kind of gods.
Used to be, yeah. Let's see there.
You shouldn't forget, no?
So,
I have a question. What is that symbol that you wrote all over?
It's fundamental analysis.
It's a box. It's supposed to be a box, but I'm a little quick about it, okay? So it's a box. All right, so it's the fundamental representation of SU4. But as you can see, that it's in a completely vector-like representations. This is unlike QCD in the sense that if you wanted to, you know, if you want to match QCD onto this, you don't have any of this sector here at all. And what you have instead is, you know, something like this, but that may carry some amount of hypercharge and some other fermions that carry different kinds of hypercharges. Okay, so this is like the quark doublet. These are like the quark singlets. Okay, the difference is that now we did specific choices.
Also like F1, what is it? 4 prime or something like
correct.
That.
Correct. Yes. It's supposed to be U and D. Okay. And again, I apologize for the writing, but yeah, so that's right. So there are Higgs interactions. So
what's the difference between F3U and the top half and F3U and the bottom half?
It's what did I do here? So did I not use what notation did I do? Oh, sorry. I knew there was something that was there. This is what I meant. Sorry. My apologies. I just wrote it incorrectly.
Yeah, okay.
So F1 and F2 can pair up to get a vector-like mass. F3 and F4D can, and these can. Okay, so there are several different vector-like masses that you can write for this theory. And you can write a Higgs interaction between F1 here and, you know, F4U or F4D, depending on how I do it. Why? Why go through all of this business? Well, okay, so the combination of the vector-like, okay, plus the Higgs interactions mean that you break all the global flavor symmetries to just U1 baryon.
Oh, very good.
If you had not introduced the Higgs interactions, there would be enlarged symmetries here, which effectively would have kept some of the mesons stable. Okay, at least stable with respect to any new physics that you decided to add to your theory. So with this assignment, with Higgs interactions, even arbitrarily small Higgs interactions, you break all the global flavor symmetries to just baryon number. What you get out of this spectrum, so this itself seems sort of somewhat obtuse, perhaps, and unnecessarily complicated, but what you get out is simply what we'll call sort of, you know, up quarks and down quarks. And by that I mean these are quarks with respect to this SU4 dark. And they're up-like in the sense that they carry +1/2 electric charge, and down means they carry -1/2 electric charge. Okay, so when you're imagining quarks in this theory, this is what it would behave as. And then there are two copies of...
You have 4 flavors.
There are 4 flavors, yeah. There are two copies in the sense of...
2 Dirac flavors.
Four Dirac fermions, of which, there's a pair of U's and a pair of D's. Okay, so that's what I mean by two copies of... These are Dirac. Okay, now Dirac now. Yep. And we worked in the limit in which there was a U-D combination that was, you know, somewhat lighter than comparison to the heavy guys, which permitted then the lattice simulations that I'll speak about to work within just 2 flavors, okay, in the theory.
And what is the capital F without the U-D label?
So this is what I call F1 and F2, and they are SU2 doublets.
So this will be the heavy ones?
Not necessarily. So that depends on the vector-like masses that you give, and it depends on the Higgs interactions.
But what you call the UD light, the ones that can charge. So.
So.
The other ones are heavy.
Yeah, but it doesn't. But it doesn't have to be these guys. It could have been the other guys or some combination. Okay. Mm-hmm. So something I'm not going to speak about today because it would take too much time. But we did consider, and we have considered, Higgs interactions with the lightest baryon. The Higgs interactions involve coupling, you know, one type to another type. And the nature of those Higgs interactions then depends a little bit on this spectrum. Okay. When I come to instead speaking about this n equal to 3 operator that I'll talk about, it won't depend on that. And so that's why I'm not being precise. Okay. I've grouped U and D together. That was not an accident. There's one. So as stated, like any other theory of any other composite theory, you know, there can be a, if I had imagined that I had, you know, arbitrary states here, U, D, whatever it may be, then obviously eventually the lightest baryon will become the one with the lightest quark. And since these carry plus or minus electric charge, the lightest baryon would be electrically charged itself. Okay, so this is one way of saying that compositeness allows the stability to be automatic, but the electric charge of it to not be automatic. That's a parameter choice. In other BSM models, you will often impose that the particle is neutral, but then you have to arrange that it's stable. So in a way, it's sort of an interesting duality between one type to another. Here we will impose that it's neutral, and we're just going to do it very simply by imposing an SU2 custodial symmetry, which is to say that I treat U and D, the light U and D, and the heavy U and D identically. That's it. So it's just put this in. And what that means is then that the lightest baryon is, you know, some suitable contraction of all of these light quarks, okay, to give me a electrically neutral and also spin singlet baryon. So that's one thing that makes SUN even obviously different than QCD, is that we have the possibility of the baryon being a scalar, okay, a complex scalar. That will help with eliminating these operators. Okay, so that sort of follows automatically from this assumption. In addition, you can show that this means that the weak isospin of this baryon is exactly zero, which means there's exactly no tree-level Z exchange in this limit. You can also show that the would-be contributions to the T parameter, and you're like, wait a second, I didn't think this broke electroweak symmetry. Well, okay, you know, you have to remember there are Higgs interactions that couple some combinations of these fermions together. So there is a small residual contribution that you have to consider with respect to electroweak breaking. With SU2 custodial, the T parameter vanishes. And the S parameter is effectively suppressed by combinations of the Yukawa coupling times the VEV divided by the vector-like mass squared. So it can be made small, and we suspect that's not a particularly strong constraint on the theory because of the vector-like masses in the theory. Okay, so you have these, and last but not least, there is a N equal to 2 operator known as the charge radius. And this also vanishes with this. Okay. This piece here is probably what is most constraining of the custodial breaking.
So this is really saying that the weak isospin charge of the baryon is zero, right?
Yes.
So what about the weak radius? Is that protected as well?
I believe that also. I believe that also vanishes, but I have to...
Can you write the charge radius operator of a scalar?
Yes, very good. So charge radius is, let me write my dynamical scale for fun as, well, I don't remember what I used over there, MB. Yeah. Squared star phi. Okay, let's do this in the non-relativistic limit where so in the non-relativistic limit, I have these things have dimension 3/2 each, so the whole thing is dimension 3. And then I have a v nu, d nu, f nu nu, mm-hmm. I believe. Okay, this is how, so this is the charge radius interaction, and when this, so just for fun, the...
Okay, for us non-heavy quark guys, can you write down where that came from? I'm sorry. No.
Where did it come from?
There is some relativistic thing that this is a non-relativistic unit from.
Well, it is. You can make this sort of, if you like, relativistic, and then, but then once you go into the non-relativistic normalization,
okay,
that's
you.
It. Okay. can I just add though that when LSD did SU3, they computed not only. So when LSD did SU3, they computed not only the polar, the magnetic moment, which is the leading operator, but they also computed the subleading charge radius, and that ended up having a constraint on their scales that was, I think, roughly a TeV or so.
Yeah.
If I remember right. Yeah. So that's, you know, it's not crazy to imagine, you know, interactions with this, and I'm not, I mean, you know, if you're a model builder so inclined, you may decide that this might be an opportunity in, of some form. But for us, because of the other restrictions that we're interested in, it's simple enough to just take this to be exact, and then all of these things vanish. Okay, so then that leaves what's left. Oh yeah, good. Okay, so we got all this way. The last, so what I have not now discussed is, so I've discussed the group, I've discussed the fermion content and their, roughly speaking, their interactions and their masses, some this global symmetry statement and what's left. So now I need to just give you a brief statement about the scales in the problem. So, okay, so if this is the fermion mass scale, where here is MF, well, you know, of order lambda dark, this is the chiral limit of MF lambda dark, and this is, if you like, the Quarconia limit.
So do you have one mass scale in this sector or more than one?
In principle, there are several scales. However, so custodial SU2 has forced upon me that I've got only two scales of the fermions now, one for these guys and one for the heavy fermions. Once the heavy ones are at least somewhat heavy, the dynamics is entirely driven by this.
So you refuse to call F1 and F2 heavy, but now you are.
Sorry, I've used.
That's what it says. Right?
You refused.
I refused.
I was pressing you before to tell me what the masses are in this theory, and you didn't, okay? So F1 and F2, are those the heavy guys you're referring to?
No, because they're mixed up through the Higgs interactions into these states.
Oh man, okay, I see.
And if you want the gore, it's in the papers.
Okay. No, I don't.
I'm skipping it. In the interest of lunch, okay, I don't think you want that. You don't want that level of, I could give it to you, but you don't want it. And the other audience definitely doesn't want it, so that I'm sure of, okay. Okay, so broadly speaking, this is where the theory could live. And so by M fermion here, I really am referring to the light fermions. Okay, you can ask that. This end would be sensitive to what's going on with the heavy ones. Let me just, you know, ignore that for now. Okay. Fine.
What number do you have in mind for lambda d?
Okay. Bear with me. Okay. But you already know that because I told you I was interested in scales of order the weak scale, I'm going to be interested in this being roughly of order the weak scale. Okay. In the chiral limit, as we all know, there are light pions. Okay, so, you know, M, and in this theory, there are charged pions, right? I mean, I take my U and B bar and I have charged pions just like QCD. Charged scalar particles that that exist in the theory have to be, you know, heavier than a left bound. Okay, so if I live in this regime, in the chiral regime, that's the sort of the naive Lepp constraint that I might apply on this. And this is, by the way, the weakest form of the constraint that I could imagine. The naive constraint would force this to be, you know, a couple hundred GeV or so. And then that, and if I'm already in the limit where lambda dark is much, much larger than M fermion, the dynamics of the baryon that are going to be set at scales, it's far larger than the electroweak scale. So this limit is perfectly fine, interesting theory to consider, not one that I'm interested in, because of the idea of trying to look at what's at the lowest scales possible. Okay.
But for the constraint, every baryon is good or not?
It could be. From the perspective of, for example, if you wanted a thermal abundance of a strongly coupled baryon, this might be a perfectly fine limit to live in.
But for rotation curves, for example.
From astrophysics, it's completely independent of this mass. Yeah. The only thing would be if you were interested in these hints of small scale structure, modifications of small scale structure due to self interactions, and then you have to begin to really play with the theories. Okay. That's a different thing. I have nothing to say about that. Okay. So I have nothing to say about that. The other limit would be Quarkonia. Okay, the fermion is much heavier than the dynamical scale. Here the issue is that, of course, the glue balls are going to be set by this scale here. And how do they decay? Well, I have to do something like that to get them to decay in this theory. That is to say, I have to go through some loop of the heavy fermions. And this operator, as you can tell, because of the number of Fs on it, is dimension 8, which means that it's scaling as sort of this dynamical scale to the ninth power divided by the fermion mass to the eighth power. So it's highly suppressed. At what point does this become a problem? It would become a problem if the glue balls decayed on timescales where you would observe or have the photons do something dangerous. One place where the photons could lead to danger would be nucleosynthesis. Uh-huh. You have heavy particles decaying the photons, they break up nuclei and...
You cannot delay that? Yeah. You cannot delay that? Yeah.
Well, okay, you have a model building opportunity now.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
You can delay it, okay. You can avoid that.
I'm coming to the Z expansion discussion. So
no, I'm not.
This afternoon.
No,
so let me just say, you can completely avoid this if MF over lambda dynamical roughly is less than, why did I write, the wrong thing on my notes, but yeah, that is what I wanted, okay? And if you do this, then this decay will happen sufficiently fast, it's not gonna be a concern. So what you can see is that there is a range of different potentially interesting theories, this is sort of not allowing you to take the fermion masses arbitrarily large. This is not allowing them to take them arbitrarily small. And if I'm actually interested in scales roughly near the weak scale, I actually want to be sort of, you know, here. All right. So I've already lost the. Hang on. All right. So in the last just couple of minutes, I want to hold you up from excessive hunger that you may have. Let me just tell you.
What does LSD have to do with all of that?
Exactly. Let me now tell you what LSD.
Is that good?
I ate my sandwich already.
Oh, I see. Oh, fantastic. Well, then in that case. What's the constraint? The 3:30 talk, right?
Sweet.
30 or nobody left in the room.
Okay, so if you're interested in a theory, in my case, I'm interested in a theory of composite dark matter with these properties, and I claim that this is an interesting region to simulate, not the only one, but one interesting range to simulate because it puts the scales roughly on top of each other and potentially allows the greatest observability possibilities with respect to this type of theory, then you're forced to do, you know, techniques at strong coupling there. And that was then the role of the LSD collaboration. So LSD, which includes me now with respect to this work, has simulated SU4 with two flavors that are the same mass and computed a series of different things, but it includes the spectrum, the sigma term that is relevant for Higgs exchange, which I'm not going to say any more about here. And so if someone wants to probe me on this, I'm happy to talk afterward about it. And then also the polarizability. And if you hadn't already guessed, the idea of, I don't know where it went, but the idea of being able to restrict to operators that go to n equal to 3 was that then now cubed with a coefficient that I'll write as, so the leading interaction of the baryon in this theory is through polarizability, of which the electric polarizability takes this form. Okay, so the velocity vector is effectively projecting out.
And
the
how did we go from 4-flavor to 2-flavor now?
Yeah, that was sort of already implicit when I said that I had these guys being light, and the other ones I took.
And kind of parametrically, they would be heavy. If the light ones are around lambda d, the two other ones would be like.
Since we didn't treat anything about them, we have no particular restriction other than, since the simulations we did are quenched, we have no dynamical fermions, and so. You know, whether I have them nearby or not is actually not directly relevant to these simulations. Okay. But if they were nearby and I did a non-quenched simulation, then I would have to worry. Yeah.
In this glue ball argument, you probably also worry about.
The which?
The glue ball argument, yeah. I mean, there's still glue balls as well, right?
So. There are still, there are still glue balls. Yep, there are. But now.
The other fermions were very heavy.
I think as long as I have one set of light fermions, then this will go through and get them to decay. And
I think,
as long as this is not hierarchically different, then this will be rapid.
I think I would have guessed the splitting between the two doublets doesn't need to be that much. We just want to make sure that the lightest fermion is neutral. So I mean, if one is, let's say one doublet is of order, well, we, in QCD terms, you would think of the strange quark, and one was twice the strange quark, that's totally fine.
I mean, maybe a different way to phrase it is, with respect to polarizability, it's actually not relevant because it's just the electric charges that matter. It would be basically, you'd have effectively a mixing between two complex scales. In the low energy effective theory, you'd look up and you'd see, you know, a multitude of complex scalars proportional to the various baryons I could construct from the fermions, and they would mix up and give me one light guy, and I'm interested in the dynamics of that one. And if what I'm interested in is this effect, then that mixing doesn't really matter. Where it would enter would be Higgs interactions, because that does have an effect of talking to the heavy and the light fermions. Okay, so this is what was done. Again, as I said, with quenched simulations, unmodified Wilson fermions, which means more to other people than it means to me, I have to admit. So. Good, but I know at least enough that I think I can tell you about what the results came out of all of this. So as I said, I'm not gonna discuss this for time, okay? Just for time reasons. In terms of the spectrum, what was actually done was to simulate, I say as a model builder, I would like fermion masses comparable to the dynamical scale. Those are not observables as directly on the lattice, as many of you may know. So instead, we were interested in the pi to rho mass ratio, and the ones that were simulated were between this range, and I think up to 9 or 9.5. There we go. Maybe it was 8.5, but anyway, it's fine. Close to that number. So, you know, this is to compare, as many of you know, probably faster than I do, but right in QCD, this is about 0.18. So this is telling me something about the relative, the mass of the fermions with respect to the dynamical scale. Okay, so these are moderately heavy fermions, right? I think would be a fair way of characterizing it. There were already, just doing sort of this analysis, and there was, in these papers.
Where does the variance sit compared to the rho?
Good. So in this range, the m baryon to m pi. Now you want me to get the sign right, but is.
I believe you, whatever you say. So.
Yeah, I'll write it this way, and then let me. Roughly 4. I think it was 3.8 or something. That was the range, and it'll take me slight effort to match it up, but you get the idea. Okay, so these states are all relatively close to each other. There's not large hierarchies between the baryons and the mesons, but they're sufficiently far away that from a collider point of view, certainly the mesons are going to be easier to produce and see. Good. So what did we learn from all of this? So there were already sort of, interesting, I would say, lattice results on just SU4 theories and comparing SU4 to SU3. This included things like looking at the so-called rotor spectrum, so these approximations of what you would expect the masses of the baryons would do as they scale with n, with number of colors, and whether one form or another would match up. Also, the polarizability itself in an SU4 theory, you could have imagined that it would not necessarily take the same form as SU3, because if I just sort of, I'm going to do my own naive little diagram here. So here's, this is, you will all, well, okay, you haven't eaten lunch yet, so you won't. You won't have any digestive issues when I draw these diagrams. But for lack of a better way of putting it, I could imagine that the fermions would pair up with each other, at least naively. And if something like this happened, you could imagine the polarizability might have been actually significantly smaller than what you could have had in, say, SU3 with otherwise, several different electric charge quarks, like in the neutron. Okay. So at least from that point of view, you get to learn some things about certain operators or the spectrum of SU4 independently. For my purpose, though, I'm only going to focus on the effect of all of this on dark matter. So let me just tell you then the results that came out and what they imply for a dark matter theory. So this coefficient was computed using a background field technique where you put an electric field onto the lattice, and then you look for the shift of the masses as a result of changing the electric field by small amounts and measuring the sort of the quadratic form of the masses as you change the electric field. It was something that we gained lots of knowledge from Will's work and collaborators on. Sorry, what? And I will. Okay. These wonderful techniques that several of you know better than I do about how to extract interesting quantities. Anyway, that's what we did, and from there you can then extract out this coefficient to an accuracy that was certainly more than sufficient from the point of view of a dark matter implication. So just to be precise then, for particular values of m pi to m rho between 0.7 to 0.77, we found this dimensionless coefficient. So I'm breaking trend of, you may think of polarizability in units of Fermi cubed or something, but I can't think that way. So I have to write it in this form so that CF is a dimensionless quantity, and we obtained between 10.5 to 13.5 over this range of pi to rho. This is, of course, a free parameter in the theory, which is characteristic of the free parameter in the theory of the relative scale of mf to m to lambda d. So you can only do, obviously, a finite number of these things because you're doing some finite number of lattice simulations. And so you can do this, and you can end up getting a single data point, well, a handful of data points, okay, on a specific theory. That's what you can get. So you can sort of, at least with respect to the particular choice of spectrum and the assumptions that went into the lattice simulation, okay, quenched and so forth, you can make a definitive statement about whether something like this happens. Okay. So this is the value you get. So this was what we got for SU4. For comparison, we did the same simulation with SU3, for the same range of fermion masses, and the numerical value here is 6.7 to 9.5. Okay, so it's a little bit larger than, but from a, you know, broadly comparable to what you had in SU3.
And in both cases, you're normalizing the CF with the measured baryon mass.
That's correct. That's how I've chosen to do it, and then we can, you know, if you prefer other units, I can show you and we can work it out. Yeah. If I do the same thing just for fun for the neutron, then if I did my conversion properly, CF measured is about 2.8. Okay? So what do I conclude from all of this? There's any number of things I, as a model builder, could conclude. One is simply that if I had taken this operator here and sort of worked in what I thought was the chiral limit and wrote this as sort of, you know, 4 pi f cubed and put in a coefficient of 1 here and assumed 4 pi f was the same as the baryon mass, I would be off on my coefficient by some, you know, non-trivial amount. Okay? Now, maybe that's not surprising because this is not in the chiral limit, okay? So I'm not suggesting that the chiral limit should have worked. I'm just saying, had I done that, I would have been off by this amount. Had I sort of taken the neutron and any amount of naive scaling, like even just super naive, or just saying, well, okay, I'm going to imagine that it's 2.8, I'd still be off by a factor of, you know, 3 to 5 or so, okay, with respect to this. Now, do I care? Do I care about 10 in this, or 3 or 5? That then goes to when I take this coefficient here, and I put it into a scattering cross-section. So let me do that. Okay, so we have, from the perspective of low energy, a scalar that has a polarizability that has now been determined to more than sufficient accuracy from the point of view of a dark matter direction detection experiment. And I want to interact with the nucleus. If this is dominated by the photon interaction off this nucleus, that is to say that if I assume that I'm getting the coherent interaction of gamma off the nucleus, all right, then I can sort of write down what the cross-section would be. And just for fun, to compare to what I started out comparing to, the per nucleon rate, this goes as squared, fourth, you know, let me do that. I don't want to write the coefficients. So Nothing is particularly surprising about this expression in the sense that the operator was suppressed by CF over MB cubed. So then in the cross section, CF squared over MB to the sixth power. These powers are made up by two powers of the reduced mass and two powers of the inverse nuclear scale. This sort of, again, under sort of this assumption, this is the scale that comes in. There is an alpha electromagnetic to the fourth power, which again is coming from the interactions that you have of this double photon exchange. And then a z to the fourth, because I've got a z squared in the amplitude, and then I'm squaring that. Okay. So notice already that, you know, whereas Higgs exchange would have had, you know, sort of an a squared in the numerator, canceling an a squared in the denominator, that doesn't happen here, which is why, frankly, the per nucleon rate is sort of a dumb thing to plot for this particular operator. Okay, but, you know, everyone plots it, so fine, we will, we'll plot it in this way and show you how big it is. So if I take this rate and then I put it back onto that plot, it's long since been erased.
What is the accuracy of that formula?
Yeah, good. So this we're not worried
about.
Is
it coefficient? Yeah. Is it comparable to CF squared?
This we're not worried about.
No, okay.
Okay. This is what you would get worried about.
Of course. Yeah.
Now, so, and your attitude then at this point is there's a different, there's various level of, yeah, there are various levels of uncertainty that you could imagine here. So when I'm putting this in, and I haven't given you the coefficient and so forth, I'm telling you that this is the rate that we get when we make this assumption and we sort of match on to what, you know, other people have made for sort of the assumption of how the gamma couples, again, in this way of coherently off the whole nucleus. But you could imagine that there would be sort of, there are two non-trivial effects. So one is there could be nuclear effects here, excitations that you could imagine, and that would change the result. So if that really happened, yes, this is off. There is also this operator of interacting with the polarizability interaction is occurring at a relatively high scale, and when you RGD evolve it down, you will generate other operators in the theory. Okay, other operators that are still proportional to CF, but they're suppressed by loops that are multiplied by logs that are moderate. So is that important? Is it not? Okay, that we suspect that then the nuclear sort of uncertainty of how you do this interaction is larger than those effects, so we've just sort of characterized it this way. In what we plotted, we had some range. Okay, there's some range of prediction that was trying to take into account the nuclear physics uncertainty. Let me just plot it though, just so I keep talking about it. This is the Lux bound, and so this is the dark matter mass in GeV. And what we found was that the line, no surprise, scales as 1 over MB to the sixth power, so a very rapid drop-off. And I still may not have plotted this quite correctly, but okay, it's close, something like that. This is where it crosses the Lux bound, and then there is a neutrino background that comes in here, where this number is roughly 10 to the minus 48 centimeters squared. And so it eventually drops below the neutrino background at this point, which is not, in principle, not, it's not that it's not detectable, it's just that now you have a background to deal.
So can you put the width on that line?
Right, so, yeah. So the width that we showed looked something like that. Now, do I fully trust or believe the particular width? That's not completely clear, because it depends on knowing this in detail. But one thing that is fairly clear is that if I had taken, right, CF to be 1, just naively, and sort of, if you like, in the Kyra limit, then this would be down by two orders of magnitude. So I'd be down here. So I'd be at a place where there would be sort of no hope of direct detection at all. So was it important to do lattice? It was important to sort of get someplace on this line, that is to say, to have some understanding as to whether there was a particular suppression here or not, and then to be able to see.
So we should be seeing sort of unstable charged mesons at 50 GeV, you know what you're saying? Or?
Oh my goodness. Okay. I will wrap up in 2 minutes, and then everyone can go to lunch.
Okay.
Is that fine? All right.
Just one question. The ratio between the CFs, isn't that 4/3?
Yeah. CFs is 4/3.
Yeah, it looks like it, yeah.
Oh, here.
It looks
right,
close.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's approximately that.
Is there some kind of argument why it's 4/3?
You know, this is a good question. You're awfully tempted to think it's what you think it is. But remember that when you do...
since CF also stands for color factor.
For some souls who really want to protract this talk and prevent people from eating. All right. There's another subtlety to this, which is that to make, a neutral baryon, I have to take charges. Here, you know, I had equal and opposite charges, plus and minus 1/2. Here, I have to do something like 2/3 and then minus 1/3, minus 1/3.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I don't know. Should that be, how do I scale those charges?
No idea.
Okay.
Good question. So I don't know precisely how I'm supposed to think about that, other than you know, calculating. Good, Eric's point. Then, what should we see? So here's m pi. This is 85, 180, 250 in GeV. The charged pions decay exactly the way the QCD pions would have decayed had they been this massive, in the sense that there is an interaction of there is an overlap of the axial current with the pions, just like the QCD pions, because of the existence of Higgs interactions. Okay. So the reason Higgs interactions were there in the first place was to ensure the pions can decay, and then those decays go proportional to whatever that effective interaction is. Of course, these decays are going to be very rapid because f pi is some large number, you know, over hundreds of GeV. So these pions decay, you know, they don't live and go to a hadronic collimator. They decay rapidly, and then they're gone, unless this parameter were taken really, really, really small. Okay.
I'm confused about that because you're not in the chiral limit, but you should shut up. Yeah, I will shut up.
Yes, that's true, and then I'll tell you after.
I mean, that matrix element still takes that form, and
precisely.
The only scale on the problem is the one that you said in the
precisely. So now below 180 tau, so pi plus would go to tau nu tau. Between this range, T V bar, and above 250, and I'm sorry, this is sort of squeezed in here, W plus Higgs. Okay. What's observable, what's not? Great question. We're thinking about it. We're working on it. Okay. We're working on it. What's observable and what's not? Some of this does not directly, you know, it doesn't directly involve lattice per se. I mean, it's just imagine you have scalars, you have some production rate, and you want to decide to what extent you can probe this. But clearly, these states could have been produced at LEP, and that bound you can sort of extract from a supersymmetric equivalent of the Stau, and that's sort of where this number comes from. So if you take that number here and you translate back using the ratio of where are we here, m baryon to m pi, you find that colliders have sort of already ruled out that. Okay, so it's sort of an interesting line of thought that you start with dark matter, you want particles, you want to imagine the scales are probable, that puts you into a certain regime where you would like to think about. I claim compositeness solves various problems and allows other features to the theory. When you try to put all the scales on top of each other, you discover that, in fact, the direct detection and the collider sort of bounds are right comparable. But again, for reasons that really had very little directly to do with, you know, the electroweak scale. It's just these are the scales that come out when you put all of these constraints together. So there's at least the possibility of, you know, direct detection in some future experiment. And if it were true, if you really found a detection consistent with spin independent, you'd be interested in looking at this ratio, right? Other elements like argon would not see a rate nearly as large as what xenon would, okay? Or tungsten might be able to be even better than what xenon can do. So that's an example of something that would come out from that. On the collider side, there is, of course, the pions, but there's the other mesons, the vector, and so forth. And understanding the dynamics of that sector and what's allowed and what's probable and maybe what's even already ruled out at LHC is ongoing work now. Thank you.